Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we hear from three of the most exciting poets at work today, Don Lundy Martin, Morgan Parker, and Inez Smith. The conversation is moderated by Portland-based writer and storyteller Bialika. The panel, titled The Body in Power, New Black Poetry, took place at Wordstock, Portland's book festival, in November 2017. This event gives us the opportunity to hear these writers read their work and then delve into a conversation about blackness and its role and experience, and also grief, the power of naming, and the question of audience. Who are these writers writing for, if anyone, and who are they not writing for? What makes this event engrossing is that these poets come from very different perspectives and so offer a wide range of responses, challenging each other, but also finding common ground. Here's our moderator, Bialika.
All right, I'm just going to jump into this with a quick introduction and a reading from each of our poets, each of whom has put out a new book that I am so excited for you to be able to access and to read and to hear a little bit from each of them today. So just going in order to my right, we have Don Lundy Martin, we have Morgan Parker, and Inez Smith.
I love y'all's work.
And I love y'all's work,
mutual.
Too. And my name is Bialika, and I am here to engage in dialogue with these exciting poets. Quick biography about each of them. So Don Lundy Martin is the author of Good Stock, Strange Blood, A Gathering of Matter, A Matter of Gathering, Discipline, and Life in a Box is a Pretty Life. Martin is also co-founder of the Black Took Collective and a member of How Do You Say Yam in African? Global Arts Collective. She is a professor of English at the University of Pittsburgh, and this is her book. Morgan Parker is the author of There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé and Other People's Comfort Keeps Me Up at Night, selected by Eileen Miles for the 2013 Gatewood Prize. Her work has been published in the Paris Review, Poetry, the New York Times, The Nation, BuzzFeed, and elsewhere. Her poetry has been anthologized in Why I Am Not a Painter, The Breakbeat Poets, New American Poetry in the Age of Hip Hop, and Best American Poetry 2016. Parker is the recipient of a 2017 National Endowment of the Arts Literature Fellowship, a 2016 Pushcart Prize, and a Cave Canem Graduate Fellowship. With Tommy Pico, she co-curates the Authors with Attitude reading series, and with poet Angel Nafis, she is the Other Black Girl Collective. And I first heard Morgan read this last spring at the Portland Art Museum from There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyoncé. And last and certainly not least, recipient of a 2017 NEA Award, Denez Smith is a Black, queer, POS writer and performer from St. Paul, Minnesota. Denez is the author of Insert Boy, winner of the Kate Tufts Discovery Award and the Lambda Literary Award for Gay Poetry, and Don't Call Us Dead, which is a National Book Award finalist. And this is his current book, or their current book, excuse me. Denez is also the author of two chapbooks, Hands on Your Knees and Black Movie, winner of the Button Poetry Prize. They are the recipient of fellowships from the Poetry Foundation, the McKnight Foundation, and a 2017 National Endowment for the Arts Fellow. Denez's work has been featured widely, including on BuzzFeed, Blavity, PBS NewsHour, and on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. They are a two-time individual World Poetry Slam finalist, three-time Rust Belt Poetry Slam champion, and a founding member of the Dark Noise Collective. Please give it up for our three astounding poets. So I'm going to turn it over to each of you to read for a brief period, if you want to go ahead and start. Great.
In order.
You.
In the order.
You can
you
decide
read.
Which order, but
really?
If you'd like to
we
go.
We have
first.
Decisions to make. I will read.
Fantastic.
Okay. So
I'm actually going to read from a section of this book, Good Stock, Strange Blood, that I don't normally read from. They're prose poems. I won't say anything about them. I'll just read them. I will say one thing about them. Is that they're... So since I'm reading from page 93, you should know that there's a figure in the book before this that haunts the book that's called the Stranger. So that when the Stranger appears here, you won't wonder who he is, right? In folds, as if between life, in life, as if outside of the border, in the bustle of some hotel room in the city you live in, under spell, under scratch of regular linens, lights to guide you, city fog, excellent. Who cares about the weather? Only the grace of looking. And you see your own body, once elderly, once gated, as a swift leap. You are no longer crippled. You say, take me to the ocean, even though the ocean has a thin layer of plastic. The metaphor is the head of my own history, the figure eight in air I make with my fingers when I'm nervous or thinking. The Stranger does not allow for memory. What does it mean to decipher this fact, an empty space in one's own cupped hands? Because we go on living despite many things. A commoner, a person just exploring life, will simply travel westward for adventure. It's quiet inside here, contorn the ear toward a wet breeze, and they ask us to think about all the world as we do, and Sontag notes only for a time it takes to think about our own safety. I am a fish, just pondering the hook. The Stranger, as we know, is no longer mine, just the particulars of him. Heavy dungeon against which we count nickels. This sensation through which we experience not want, but a material made between bodies on a bed not touching. What can be accessed only because it cannot be reached. Thank you.
That was dope. I want Dawn to narrate my whole life. She's like, that voice is amazing. I'm gonna start at the beginning. I'm just gonna read the first poem and the last poem. And then we'll listen to Dines. All they want is my money, my pussy, my blood. I am free with the following conditions. Give it up. Gimme, gimme. Okay, so I'm black in America, right? And I walk into a bar. I drink a lot of wine and kiss a black man on his beard. I do whatever I want because I could die any minute. I don't mean YOLO, I mean they are hunting me. I know my pussy is real good because they said so. I say to my friend, I am broke as a joke. I'm starving like Marvin Gaye. I'm so hungry I could get it on. There's far too many of me dying. The present is not so different. Everybody looks like everybody I worked with. Everybody looks like everybody I kissed. Men champion men and animals. Everybody thinks I'm gonna die. At the museum, I tell the school group about black art. I tell them the word contemporary. I have a nose ring I forget about. I have a brother and he is also black. I'm a little modern to a fault. I say, this painting is contemporary, like you and me. They ask me about slavery. They say Martin Luther King. At school, they learn that black people happened. The present is not so different. I'm looking into their black faces. They do not understand that they exist. I'm black in America, and I walk into a bar and drink a lot of wine, kiss a white man on his beard. There is no indictment. I could die any minute of depression. I just want to have sex most of the time. I just want my student loans to disappear. I just want to understand my savings account. What is happening to my $5 one cent? I am free with the following conditions. What is happening to my brother? What if I do something wrong? My blood is so hot and wet right now, I know they want it. I do everything right just in case. I don't want to give away my money, but here I am. It's so stupid I have to say here I am. They like to be on top. I'm being set up. I'm a tree, and some fruits are good and some are bad. Thank you all. So I'm just going to read the last poem. It's a little shorty, named after a Coltrane song. So what? If a pill comes into bed with me, melon-colored dawn is liquid, grandma's lipstick, repentance becoming sky. I am tired of coveting. This is where I hang my hat and kiss myself hello. This is the way it feels to lose. My vision is wind and light. Bottles and men are covered in snow. They touch their lips to a horn. Magical powers are everywhere. Fingernails, post offices, indoor cactus spines. Everyone gets married to everyone. There's song and dance and drink. Vacant lots confess their flowers. I swallow bold colors because so what if I have more regrets than birthdays? I'm old for my age. I'm made of water. Why do you get up in the morning?
Y'all so good. I enjoy thinking about that poem, Morgan, about as also after the great American classic So What by Field Mob and Sierra.
Whoa,
right?
Deep cut.
Deep cut. Deep cut. Deep cut for those of you who were black in the early 2000s. Yeah. Which is a few of us in here. This is the most black people I've seen in Portland, by the way. It's good to see
Thanks
y'all.
Thanks for coming to be with
thank
us.
Thank you. I can literally point. Thank you. What's up? Thank you.
That's good.
It's good to know that we're here. All right. So I'm going to read from the first poem in the book. The book begins with a long poem that tries to imagine a afterlife that is exclusive to black men who have been murdered by the police, who have been killed by the functions of whiteness in some way, shape, or form. This is called Summer Somewhere. Somewhere a sun below. Boys brown as rye play the dozens in ball. Jump in the air and stay there. Boys become new moons, gum dark on all sides. Beg bruised blue water to fly, at least tide, at least spit back a father or two. I won't get started. History is what it is. It knows what it did. Bad dog, bad blood, bad day to be a boy. Color of a July well spent. But here, not heaven, not earth, boys can't recall their white shirt turned a ruby gown. Here, there is no language for officer or law, no color to call white. If snow fell, it'd fall black. Please, don't call us dead, call us alive someplace better. We say our own names when we pray. We go out for sweets and come back. This is how we are born. Come morning after we cipher, feast, hoop, we dig a new one from the ground, take him out his tree box, shake the worms from his braids. And sometimes they'll sing a trap god hymn, what a first breath. And sometimes it's the eyes who lead, scanning the room for bone flesh men in blue. We say, congrats, you're a boy. Again, we give him a do-rag, a bowl, a second chance. Send him off to wander for a day or ever. Let him pick out his new name. That boy was Trayvon, now called Rain King. That man, Sean, named himself I do. Oh, the imagination of a new reborn boy. But most of us just settle on alive. Sometimes a boy is born right out the sky, dropped from a bridge between starshine and clay. One boy showed up, pulled behind a truck, a parade for himself in his wet red gown. Years ago, we plucked brothers from branches, peeled their naps from bark. Sometimes a boy walks into his room, then walks into his new world, still clutching those wicked metals. Some boys waded through their own blood to hear. Does it matter how he got here if we're all here to dance? Grab a boy, spin him around. If he asks for a kiss, kiss him. If he asks where he is, say gone.
I just want to share that in reading these three very unique books individually, doing amazing things, it's difficult to put them all together and try to have a short conversation about them. So I just want to acknowledge that going into it. And we are going to try to leave time for a few questions at the end, so be thinking of those as we go. To start us off, the name of this panel is The Body and Power, New Black Poetry. And I've been thinking a lot about how in your respective works, the body may be abstract, it may be a metaphor, it could be an uncontainable concept, it could be working in the function of trying to convey something that is even unrecognizable as a body. But I've also been thinking about bodies literally and how we might think about the bodies that enter into spaces expecting to receive something and not bringing energy, but expecting that energy coming back. Even in a space like this, we might imagine that kind of dynamic. So I've been thinking about how you, how in your works you're conveying this idea of the body. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about the body, each of you, and how you thought about it in crafting your individual poems, and also maybe in the way that you craft the book. Because the book itself, I know, is maybe an ineffable space to try to keep intact.
I can start. I'll say that, you know, it depends on which bodies in the poems are being referred to. I mean, I think if we're talking about explicitly like the black body, it becomes almost impossible to render the black body in language because the black body is both at the same time the most possible radical being in the world, and simultaneously a fiction or a creation. Mm. And so like to come to language that approaches or approximates both of those things is, you know, it's the work of the poem, mm-hmm. Right? And so I think that, you know, trying to like get that right or circle around language that gets that right or whatever. So I think that's like the struggle. And, you know, I was listening to Fred Moten this morning because for some reason, it's not exactly what he says all the time, but I find Fred Moten's voice really soothing. It's like, I just turn it on. It's like, you know, some people turn on the ocean. You know, I
do. Yeah, a little Fred Moten noise machine.
I love that.
I'm just like, oh,
give
you
me
know.
One of those.
Yes. Working out, doing some push-ups and sit-ups, and then like Fred Moten, you know. and so, but one of the things that he was talking about, you know, I did hear what he was saying, and one of the things that he was talking about is the black people, the black body being kind of like everything, and in the way that he, in his first book, kind of wants to take back the very first sentence because it nails it down, like what that one possibility might be. But really, it's like everything that is said, once you put all of those things together and like some like weird invisible network of sayings becomes like the thing itself, right? And you can't render that in the poem, and in a poem, right? So I think that's the problem. That's on the one side. On the other side, in this particular book for me, there is a figure that is an I that gets really close, I think, to me. And so I am actually trying to write through childhood trauma as I've been doing since my very first book, but I think, you know, more explicitly, and who knows, it's probably completely abstract, I don't know, but it feels more explicit to me in this book because of this stranger who haunts the book and does things to the child body. And so that to me feels like, you know, a kind of stand-in for this ghost child that lives inside of me. So, again, I think it depends on which bodies. The body in power or the body and power?
And
power, uh-huh. Or not power, right. Or unpower. Mm. Anyway, go ahead.
Ooh, could go on forever. I do want to affirm that I do see the shift, the closeness in this book than your previous. I can see that happening. It's exciting. I'm proud of you.
Oh, thank you.
I think, I always say that my project as a poet is just try to, as best I can, make the reader understand and really understand, not just like passively, but actively understand what it's like to live in this particular body in this particular time, in the particular places that I'm in. So I'm, you know, throwing in all of these things and references and all of that just to try to kind of really get at what my experience is. And my experience is 100% informed by the body that I'm in. That's my choice, not my choice. It's very complicated and complex and layered. And that's the poem begins and ends with me living in this body, you know? I have, I don't know, the whole the body thing. I have one poem that I've memorized by myself. I don't memorize my poems, but I do know this one from my newer collection, and it's about the body and this idea of, like, the body, how everyone says, you know, like, in school, like, well, the body. It's like, that was my Yusuf Kaminyaka impression. Oh, the body. I'm like, huh? What are we talking about? It's so abstract. So this poem, I'll just recite it to you guys. It's called Magical Negro Number 80, The Black Body. Give it a new verb. Stop writing poetry. Go outside. Make blood. The body is a person. 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 The end. So I just feel like we should be careful. I'm like a theory nerd, so I'm there and I get it on one hand, but I also think that like so much of just where we are in America right now, where we are when America started, is because it is abstract and it need not be, because there's a person inside of the body, you know? So, and let's create space for that person as well. So anyway, let's talk about what's going on inside the body.
Right. I wonder about that. Because I think there has to be space for like all of that, right? Like I think about poetry as a site for like extreme possibility. Yep. And I love that like my like, you know, black queer body in a poem can also just like be a river, if I deem it so, or it can like burst into like a whole bunch of hamsters if I like write it down. Poetry's possible, y'all. And I love that sort of like theoretical body. I think for me in my work, my eye has always been me, and my body has always been my body. I think especially in this book, it's thinking about mortality in a very upfront way, both like what it means to like sort of like live in a police state with like state sanctioned or like state encouraged or state traditional violence against your people and your body. But then also the book thinks about my diagnosis with HIV and like what it meant to like touch mortality in a new way through that. So yeah, I think about like as my book, like as the poems being like a site to like reclaim my own body, and to like sort of, I think poems are maybe some of the freest spaces until I know how to be free out here.
I think the poem is like one of the only spaces where like my body, that's maybe the realest body I have, is the body in the poem, or the body that I'm allowed to create in the poem, whether that be mine or others, right? I think poetry has for me and the body allowed a space for healing, both physically and emotionally, that like isn't always possible in this tangible world. And so I kind of see like poems as like this weird ritualistic act of like actually trying to like call forth the peace and the justice and the bodies that I have into this actual world. But it like pleases me to like think about the body. I also sometimes it feels weird. I do get that like academic sense of like the body. I like how you say it, the body.
and it's like, I'm like weird, who's?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, whose body? And like, you know, and like if we're gonna like claim it, then like, you know, because I think for a lot of writers of different identities, it like we have no choice but to think about our bodies, not only in our work, but in our daily lives, you know? I do not have the privilege of not thinking about how my body moves through space. Mm-hmm. None of us on this stage do. And so I think that brings a different kind of relationship to the body in poetry. You know, white dudes can kind of like do that weird thing of like the lyric eye speaking into a space is sort of like bodiless voice. And it's just like, yeah, but that's because you're white and a dude, you know, and like probably straight. And so like you can do whatever the fuck you want.
White man's proverb.
Yeah. Ooh, Lord. But yeah, so I think the body has always been like a very personal and weighed down thing in my work. And I'm actually trying to work towards like getting more towards that like metaphorical theoretical body and like being able to have that freedom where like it doesn't have to be my literal blood in every poem.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not sustainable.
I think that like for like we theorize the black body in part because like we often experience the world as objects and not people.
Ooh, yep.
So, you know, like we've been claiming personhood since we were first dragged upon these shores. So, and that claim over and over and over and over again has not yielded in the eyes of a lot of people. I mean, they are all coming out of the woodworks now, right? So like a lot of people, this idea of personhood, right? And so like, that's that question, like how do we even get there to this, you know, all agree on this very simple concept.
It's real basic.
Like, I am a person.
The body has a person inside of it. I'm like, you know, and that's, I think, you know, this abstract, and it's easy to talk about, you know, lives, bodies. I'm like, yeah, but straight up, you just walked right into me on the street. You know, like, yeah. So I get a little bit, I don't know. I'm on both sides. Of that kind of argument, because I do think that the body is separate in this weird way, but it's also not, and both have to be true. You know, we're inside here, we have souls, you know? And just because, well, the other thing is it's the multiplicity, right? Like that's what the poem can do. I think once we start to try to define things, the reason it all falls apart is because like, it's impossible. You know, there's so many, linear time doesn't exist. We're all silly ancestors hanging out. I mean, there's no one way to describe, a self. And so I think that the poem, you can be, you can have multiple voices. You can be in multiple time space continuums. It's like it's the most honest rendering of what it's like to be alive.
I feel like as like a materialist atheist philosopher, we have to talk later. like what's happening? Yes, but I know what you're saying. I feel you.
We can cross-reference like terms. Books.
This is what happens when you say the word body around poets, like, y'all. This is what
it's a whole lot.
This is literally the panel.
I'm glad we're leading with that. And Don, I'll throw it back at you for just a second, because I think you actually in your book are doing you're working, I felt like I was seeing you work through the question of the undefinable in a structural sense, like through creating a cast of characters who are in some cases not even visibly, you know, they're undefinable. Obviously I'm thinking of one in particular that is undefinable. And I'm thinking about that in relationship to the kind of inexpressibility of grief And I think all of you are playing with grief, working with the concept of grief and grieving, which sometimes doesn't have language. Mm-hmm. And I think there's the term grief mouth that comes out of your writing. And I don't know if this is a question as much as just kind of following up on how grief and the indescribability of it or the inexpressibility of it makes its way into your work. And could you?
I mean, it's a big question. The thing that I want to say is I want to say something about what I'm working on now, which is I'm working on these essays. And one of the things that I find I find it really difficult to shut the world out from the essay. Like, I have this idea about this essay I'm writing. It's like, you know, autobiographical, kind of memoirish. And then, like, there's the frittering around the surface, like, you know, another Black person gets killed by police, wham, like that happens. And then, you know, something else really horrible happens. And so, one, as a creative person, like, what does the creative mind do in that moment? Like, what you really want is like your space of creativity, but you can't be there with that part of your head lifted when there's this other stuff just always kind of infringing. That's a kind of creative grief. It's a grief in the creative moment. And so this essay that I'm working on now is I'm really letting those moments come into the work explicitly as kind of like interruptions to whatever story I'm trying to tell about my own life. Because you can't, I mean, it's impossible to be free of it. So I think there are strategies for like working out in the creative moment, like how to grapple with grief, which is, you know, if it's a melancholic grief, then it's like unhealable. You're just outside of yourself, mm-hmm. right? So you're always the fraught person. And what does that yield? It yields lots of things. It yields a sense of hopelessness. It can yield a sense of depression. It can yield, you know, whatever it does to you, whatever kind of havoc it wreaks on your interiority. But although reclamation might not be possible, I think that in the creative act, we can find, you know, in that grappling, in that attempt, something I can't put name to, but something else happens where, you know, grief or melancholy or trauma become not so, they lose some of their power, you know, on who we are.
I think about grief as a very useful emotion in my life and in my work, but I think how it maybe manifests in my work is trying to end the thing that creates the grief. I welcome grief. I think it's useful. It's even good. You know, I like grief a little bit. I think I like grieving. It feels good to grieve. But like my book is very much interested in like sort of battling back against what not only creates personal grief, but more community grief, mm-hmm. what creates grief within within a people, and how do we sort of combat, like, sort of that type of useless grief, I think. The grief that is created out of malice and out of evil and out of injustice. But I'm friends with grief. I don't really know what to say about it. I think my work is very Afro-pessimist in a way, where it like has to engage with grief. Afro-pessimism, for those of y'all who might not know, is
learned about this.
I did too. somebody told me I was an Afro-pessimist, and so I had to figure it out.
Someone told me that I was, and I was like, nuh-uh.
Uh-huh. And then they told you, was like, yeah.
I know that I'm like very medicated, but like.
Look here. This is all those words.
But when I'm negative, I'm just playing.
Yeah.
Exactly. But like, you know, I learned that I was Afro-pessimist. I learned that I do a thing called Duende. I don't know what that was for a real long time.
For sure do that.
Yeah.
for sure.
But like, Afro-pessimism is like this idea that like Black people are always sort of like living like on the, how am I gonna describe it right? Like on the cusp of like some grief, or basically like, you know, like we always are kind of like we're like blackness and black death kind of go hand in hand. And we sort of are always sort of like living, even within our joy, in this shadow of this like grief, this murder, this oppression. And so I think I'm like, what my, this book especially, I think it just, it like does allow itself to languish in the grief and to like experience the full breadth of that grief and not shy away from it. And then it becomes interested in like, okay, how do we actually do something about this? So this, so we don't become stuck in this feeling. How do we break out of Afro-pessimism and become some Afro-optimists somewhere down the line?
I personally, I've now coined, I am an Afro-realist.
Ooh.
You know what I mean? I'm just saying the truth. If you think it's sad, imagine living it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying it's
literally just saying what's happening in the world.
I'm just literally saying facts. And that's what I will continue to do. I think, yeah, I'm so intrigued by that. And the first time someone said it to me, I was like, oh, uh-oh. You know, I know that I often engage with death, fear of death, violence, and trauma, and sadness. But I like to think that, like, there's a heroic end. I mean, I've called this book, like, My Iliad. And I really think there's, like, meant to be a hero's journey. And I really do think that, like, at the end, this bitch is still alive. You know what I mean? And that is, I don't see anything pessimistic about it. The endurance, the audacity of just, like, being, and taking a bath and, you know, just saying, so what? I like fought with my editor on including that last poem, but I wanted it to be just like this kind of quiet moment of here's all these objects, here's all these people. And so what, you know, why do you get up in the morning? Why do I, but we do. And, I think it's a hopeful note.
I think so too.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just pose one more question or theme to the panel, and then we'll open it up to questions. But kind of building off of this, and also from what you were saying, Dinez, about kind of being resistant to this idea of the Afro-pessimist, there's another concept, or another name for that concept of the death-bound subject, to think about the black subject as already, you know, always already thinking about death and already prepared for that death. Which to me really resonates with the title, Don't Call Us Dead, and kind of thinking about or rethinking, redefining what that means, you know, what death looks like through resurrection and through the way that you revivify the body. So my question really is to about naming and the importance or power of naming, and sometimes literally names. Thinking also about the names of the boys that you name in the poem that you started with. There is the danger, I suppose, of appropriating the names of those who've been murdered, and commodifying. And you can hear, you know, spoken word poets talking about, like, I'm gonna win this competition because, and being critical of that, because I've dropped the name, you know. And I don't feel that that's what's happening in any of your work, but I want to really think about what it means to powerfully rename something or to give the name back. And just as a passage, there's a really quick line. This is from your book, Dinez. We asked for nothing but our names in a mouth we've known for decades. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a... Go.
Wait. So what's the question? So just like what? How do we see naming in our work? And what was the power? What is the power of naming? What are some of the dangers of that as well?
Yeah, and I'm thinking about naming in a way that protects it, the name from being appropriated.
Word.
Particularly word. By a white audience that may try to take over a black experience.
Name.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. That.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I don't know, this question is like a white audience, like, hi, white audience, and like, just so y'all know, I don't think about y'all until I think about y'all, and I usually alert it in a poem when I'm talking to white people. I think
I think there's a danger in any type of naming, whether that be these sort of like popular names that are like popular because of the popularity of Black Death and that type of cultural capital that scarily handle has. But even like naming a family member, you know, I think naming yourself in a poem to like actually bring up your own body and say, this is me. Like, it's a hard act to like bring up a name in a poem. But I think I think you have to appropriate a little bit. I think, you know, and I think everybody's barometer for what appropriation is different. And so you have to really like handle that in yourself. I hear poems all the time that I feel like grossly use the names of murdered people of all types of races and situations and backgrounds, or just, you know, like I hear a poet talk about people from Palestine in just like some really gross ways. And like just trying to, you know, use that as a capital to build up something that they imagine is good work. That isn't. And I think what it does for me, I think it is, it makes my hand more careful when I'm writing. You know, I really have to ask myself, like, what am I doing with this name? Is it honoring somebody? Would I still write this name down if I write Trayvon Martin's name down, if I had to look his mother in the eye while I read this poem, you know, and if I can't answer up to the people that have named him, then I won't write the name down. I think you just have to stand behind your work in that way, but also trust and also be skeptical of yourself. I'm highly cautious and nervous in that act of naming, but it goes through many edits and the names come in and out of the poems. But eventually I think I try to settle on a place where it feels like it is most useful, and it also feels like it's doing some type of justice or honoring to the folks that I'm mentioning. And whether that be through a lens of like Black Death and police brutality, or like, you know, I have to be very careful when I bring up my like grandfather or my grandmother in my work, you know, and like how to, you know, not talk bad about the family in public while also speaking honestly, which is really hard shit. And also, like, I have to, like, be careful with myself, just, like, you know, what am I willing to share with people? You know, everybody who's read my book has, like, read a lot about me, and they can assume a lot of things, and there's danger in that. And so I think, but I like that risk, and I think poetry is about managing that risk and sometimes failing, but hopefully in a good way.
I feel like pretty ridiculous right now because I wrote a book with Beyonce's name in it, and that's like not the deep that you're talking about. So I'm just gonna.
Oh yes, it
I'm
is.
I'm gonna take an L on
oh,
this
yes,
one.
Oh yes, it is. Oh come on. Well, you're naming a name and having us think differently about that name, like calling into question what we think we know when we see that name.
Right. Mm-hmm. I kind of don't live in the realm of these like hashtag name poems. I'm so uninterested in that sort of thing. As performance, you know, I'm not here for it. So yeah, my dumb self just includes names of Beyonce and Real Housewives and just, I mean, I wrote this poem, 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Girl, that has a bunch of Black women's names. And I think, yeah, I want a lot of Black women in all my books. So I just bring them up. Like compulsively almost. I'm just like, also Diana Ross. You know what I mean? Like I just need them to be in the space with me. And it's less about the name and more just about the population of folk. And sometimes it's a little bit of a kind of like calling on, you know? Mm. So I think when I think about naming, I'm really thinking about it in that way, not necessarily in a, like a memorializing way, but really as, like kind of bat signal of Black women, like get in here, you know? And I, you know, started with Beyonce and also am thinking about a lot of figures throughout history. And it really is an opportunity for me to take someone else's strength. That's really what it began as, like, listen, this is very sad. What if it's wearing sequins, you know? And then that becomes, what if I'm speaking in the voice of Angela Davis? Like, who can I lean on when I'm feeling like I'm lacking? So it really was a kind of a writing tool to kind of use someone else's voice when I felt like mine couldn't do the thing on its own. So that's really why kind of names and bodies come into my work, I think.
I was kind of thinking along the lines at the beginning of the question about free spaces, about feeling free. And, you know, like Afro-pessimism doesn't make any sense to me because of all the spaces in which we feel free as Black people, as queer people, as women, and there are lots of them. There are lots of those moments that are like ecstatic in their freedom. But I also wanted to say that historically, I mean, like, so I'm old. I grew up in the 70s. And in the 70s, even though, like, you know, we're supposed to be making this trajectory toward being better humans, but in some ways, like, it's almost like the 70s were, like, less hostile to Black people. In this essay that I just wrote that's coming out in January, I'm writing about how there's just one moment when my brother gets arrested when he's just like 14, and there's his kids in this car, and they stole this car. And the police let them, they bring them to the police station, but then they call the parents, or, you know, all the kids' parents, and they're like, look, we're not going to charge them this time, but, you know, keep an eye on them. You know, my father certainly was punished him in a way probably worse than the police, but that's a different story. But the story is that, you know, so in that moment, there was like, you know, the 14-year-old Black boys were seen as boys. Even then, some moment where, you know, times where we didn't feel so regulated by, you know, the regimes that seek to oppress. There are always spaces of freedom.
I just want to sit with that for a moment. Okay, I think we should move on to questions, and we're probably going to be able to take maybe just one, so make it a good one. Maybe two.
You better have a question mark at the end.
That would be...
Straight up.
That's right.
Yes.
Oftentimes when I share the work of Black writers, some people will push back because they'll be like, oh, the language of this writer, I don't feel comfortable with it. I don't like that you shared that as a white person. And I'm like, I don't think that it's my right to erase the voice of the writer.
True that. Show them white people talking about whiteness.
Yeah.
Actually, and that's another thing. Like, if you're a white writer in the room, go write about being white. Talk about being white. Talk about that experience. Maybe it's not sharing our work. Wesley Rothman just released a book called Subwoofer, which is an excellent collection if you want to start someplace about thinking about poetry of white folks talking about what it means to be white. Do that, you know? Share your, but there's... Right, but I think what you're hearing from your timeline is that amplifying our voices is not what the people that are arguing with you need to hear. They actually need to hear you talk about what it means to be white. They need to have that type of open dialogue. If they aren't able to actually listen and read Black folks, then maybe don't share them with Black folks.
Yeah.
You know, if my grandma hates hip hop, I'm not gonna still cram it down her throat until she likes it, you know, but I'm gonna maybe talk to her about some other things to try to meet her at a point where I feel like we can have some type of conversation. And maybe that conversation is not started with a Black voice to that particular sect of people that you're talking about right now.
I also think, you know, that discomfort is a good thing.
Yep.
Amen.
So
I'm uncomfortable literally all the time.
Right.
Every second of every day.
All of the times that we are in, you know, situations as Black people where we feel uncomfortable or threatened, like actually threatened, those are, you know, those proliferate all the time, right? So like that moment of discomfort is actually the I agree with Dinez that, no, certainly, you know, there are other ways of getting to these issues, like white people talking to white people. But I also think that in that moment of discomfort where you hear something that you don't want to hear, like that's the exact moment that you that they need to be guided towards self-reflection.
There's so many folks who will read your work in some ways that you're engaging in rendering Black bodies and Black people won't be legible to them. But how do you do that while also negotiating like the richness of your Blackness and your voice?
In the moment of writing, like I'm really interested in working something out. I'm really interested in the questions that haunt me. I'm interested in trying to figure out this in this medium that I use, language, like how to get there, what's important to me to say. So I'm not actually thinking about the world outside of that moment at all. In fact, I'm not writing to anyone in particular. You know, sometimes I will, you know, have like a joke in my book. Like in this one, the joke is I should write about black things or nobody's going to read this book. So then there's like a section right in the middle called the black bits. And like all around that, I'm like, oh, I know you want me to write about black stuff, right? And that happens all throughout this book. And so, you know, so sometimes that happens. But like really, I'm trying to like work out something that's I'm writing like about the obsessions that haunt me, you know? Yeah. And then hopefully what Nathaniel Mackey says, he's like, you know, the work creates the audience,
yep.
Right? Like, you're not like, oh, I have this audience. I'm just going to talk to this audience over here in the corner. Yeah.
100%. I'm like, I'm going to write my stuff and then people will either catch up or not catch up. You know, they'll join me in the room or they won't. Mm. But I'm always going to be doing my thing, answering my questions, working out problems, and creating something that just feels authentic to me. I mean, there's an awareness of an audience that enters in like an editing phase, you know, but it's also like, maybe the audience will hate this. I straight up said to a friend the other day, I don't think you're gonna like my next book. Like, you know, it's not all about kind of like speaking to. You're speaking and it's like, you could listen or not listen, you know? But the writing itself has to operate on its own level and just kind of do its thing. It's like beyond me.
Retweet what they said.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing the stage.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
That conversation was from a panel called The Body and Power, New Black Poetry, a panel that took place at Woodstock, Portland's Book Festival in 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.